Hello everyone, I'm Nate Truex, and you're listening to the CrocCast Podcast. Hello everyone, welcome to the CrocCast Podcast. I'm your host, Nate, and today I'm joined by Dr. Bruce Eilerts. Bruce, welcome to the show.
Thanks. I don't have a PhD, but thanks for the compliment.
So I want to get us started on how you first got into reptiles and your career path leading up to this point.
Sure. Well, I've got a zoology degree, Bachelor of Science, and was going for a higher degree, but I wound up volunteering for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and spent a year out in the remote Hawaiian Islands with seabirds, sea turtles, Hawaiian monk seals, and after a year, position opened, and I beat out 3 master's degrees and 1 PhD with my Bachelor of Science simply because of the volunteer work. So I wanted to let everybody know that's a real way in if you want to work for orgs, especially government agencies. They pay for your transportation, room and board, and training, pretty good deal if you just have the time. After that, you know, I went into, as I said, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, then later Department of Defense, became the deputy director of the Goldwater Range out here in Arizona, 2.7 million acres, locked up and not all getting blown apart. Most of it is just locked up for security, airspace, keeping the yahoos out. And because of that, Department of Defense has 25 million acres of land. A lot of people don't realize that. That's natural, wild, and guarded, literally in some places, with soldiers and weapons. Sadly, what we probably need nowadays. Anyway, then I went on to Center for Biodiversity, worked for Arizona Department of Transportation, did a lot of wildlife connectivity relating to desert tortoise, mammals, large mammals, that sort of thing, and worked for various consulting firms, and I just recently retired. So still active in terms of being interested in conservation and herps and birds and all of that. And basically that's it in a nutshell.
Yeah. I have heard somewhere before that like military bases and training facilities are inadvertently great wildlife conservation areas. So I have heard that before.
Absolutely. It's kind of a best kept secret. There's about 800 Department of Defense, I'll refer to as DOD, biologists, natural resource managers, you know, naturalists, that kind of thing. From Guam to Puerto Rico and all 50 U.S. states. And it's been a great job. You know, one difference with the DOD as opposed to the Department of Interior, another resource agency, is you know, the resource agencies have become seriously politicized, as you know, and really gets in the way of the Endangered Species Act and recovery management. DOD, you know, in many cases, there's a conflict. You know, they have a mission to perform, and they know they have to abide by the rules under the Sykes Act, one of the many. And, you know, the wing commander, general in charge of the Air Force facility I was at, would call me in. Hey, I got this issue. Tell me what to do. You know, that's refreshing.
Yeah.
And and a lot of times, what are the options? Here you go, sir. You know, we weigh them and all right, let's do it. You know, Fish and Wildlife Service, good God, you know, Senator so-and-so, this golf course developer's involved, you know, watch how you speak to the media and all. Oh, drove me nuts. But yeah, there's a lot of good things about the DOD. Yeah, kind of like Bambi versus Godzilla, if you will.
It's pretty funny. So what were some of the – did you mention you did work with desert tortoises? You want to go into more detail about that?
Sure. Don't want to date myself, but we started out with radio telemetry. Which went to satellite telemetry and GPS out here in the deserts. And I also worked as a consultant in Las Vegas, most recently on those power lines, you know, from Hoover Dam down to Los Angeles. They're putting in new power corridors. And sadly, Southern Nevada on the California border, there's one of the last holdouts for desert tortoise. Some of the research has been done recently is showing that because of the climate change and hotter springs and summers, the time tortoise are out and about looking for a mate has drastically shortened, you know, and because of that, in most areas of the desert tortoise range right now, they're not breeding. They're not reproducing. The problem with that is people go out and see desert tortoise, they're seeing adults, you know, that are not reproducing and maybe the last in their area. And then when they go, you have extirpation across the board. So Southern Nevada, for whatever reason, we still have a viable breeding population. So I'm not saying breeding doesn't occur everywhere else, but the data is showing so low, it's scaring the heck out of everybody. And what the answer is, I really don't know. As you probably know, the disease from the release of Chinese tortoises and other things the public ignorantly does has introduced a deadly respiratory virus into the population. So that, combined with habitat loss and climate change, our poor desert tortoises aren't doing too well. But anyway, along with that, we have many other species we're concerned about, you know, the long-nosed leopard lizard, Gila monster. Basically, the ecology and the habitat in general, we're trying to protect what's left. Because, as you know, the Southwest has a rich herp fauna.
Yeah. I was fortunate enough to actually find a baby desert tortoise once, a little less than 4 years ago. So,
really? Where were you at? In the Sonoran or Mojave?
The St. George area of Utah.
Oh, okay. That's Mojave Desert. Actually, like getting Southwest in the Great Utah. Basin, Mojave. Yeah. Yeah, that's good news. Really good news.
Yes. Yeah. And it was totally by accident. Just walking around looking for Chuck Wallace. Little did I realize me and my friend, who are not from the Southwest, obviously, we were looking at small, rocky, open plain instead of, up on big rock faces. We were just walking around. I was walking around, and I just looked down next to my foot, and there's this little about yay-sized desert tortoise.
Yeah. They don't look real, do they? Looks like one of those little plastic toys when they're holding
perfect
still.
Dome.
And they. Yeah, yeah, beautiful.
Yeah, so I'm just glad my foot was a few inches to the left or the right instead of the other way
that's
around.
That's for sure. You know, it's really tough, all the off-road vehicle activity out there. That's scary. They're hard to see even if you're trying to avoid them.
Yeah. So what are some things people can do to help with desert tortoise conservation?
Sure. Well, when you're out there, anybody interested in herps is basically, if they want, collecting data. Sightings like yours of a juvenile, a baby tortoise, the location. Feel free to take GPS coordinates of tortoise you find, any tortoise you find. If you see a tortoise, well, don't touch it, obviously. Don't get in the way of daily activities. Yeah, I'm sure you didn't. But if you look at them, especially through binoculars, you can pretty much notice if they've got that respiratory disease. You know, unfortunately, their face is covered with mucus. You know, it looks like they're drooling almost, and it's horrible. But, you know, this information, adult or baby, location, you know, a GPS coordinates would be great. Did it look okay? You know, is it missing any limbs or did it have any sign of respiratory disease? Even if you don't find live tortoises, you know, the ravens are taking a toll on desert tortoise. You'll go to a a power tower out there, and maybe a nest, and you'll just see all these empty baby tortoise shells at the bottom of the tower. It's horrible. But again, you know, location, you saw a tortoise, because they will manage, you know, they'll go out and deal with ravens that are really taking a toll on the tortoise. So basically all of those things are really important. You know, there's a lack of field biologists out there. There's not a lot of money in the budgets to fund research or even fund management. So citizen biologists are real important.
Yeah. So what are some other reptile species you've worked with?
Gila monster, long-nosed leopard lizard, chuckwalla to a lesser extent here in the Southwest. Worked a lot with sea turtles in the Pacific, but that's a whole different area. But, you know, the leopard lizard is a real cool little, the leopard lizard is a really cool little predator. And, again, that one's on the decline. They like to come out on the dirt and gravel roads and sun the same time all the ATV activity is going on out there. And it's really rough to see when they get hit. But just you asked, what can people do? You know, be aware. Take notes, you know. And again, that information, all you have to do is email it to your local, each state is different, game and fish, forestry and wildlife, whatever it might be, and the feds. Now, in general, you've got the bureaucrats who, okay, thanks, you know, we've got all the data we need. That's the wrong answer from them. But there's people like you and I who are very interested working for these agencies who would love to just get an email. And actually, they probably say, hey, you want to go out sometime? You know what I mean? And do a survey with me or a check. You know, I did work with some yellow leg frogs in California briefly, that sort of thing. But as I said before, volunteering, you'd be surprised at how willing agency personnel and agencies themselves are to take volunteers out and actually go out on your own. They'll give you the, sometimes they'll give you the satellite or radio tracking equipment, you know, to go out and actually, I had a friend doing Gila monster work in Nevada, in the McCullough mountain range south of Vegas, and she would go out every couple of days and just see where the Gila monsters are, tracking them. And it's just amazing how tortoise and Gila monsters get around. They'll cross under interstates, you know, through drainage tunnels and stuff, and they're busy little guys, and they will, you know, they'll plot this and produce maps, and we can learn a lot from that. So that's a, you know, I really ask that you tell your followers, you know, to feel free to get involved. And I sort of went over that already. I don't mean to beat a dead horse, but that really is great. Plus, it's a lot of fun. Feeding, though. Yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, 190 degrees, insects bursting into flames, you know, a little rough out there in the summer. Not that bad, but you know, last summer was the hottest in Earth's history. And I think Phoenix went 40 some days at 115 degrees plus. And that's just, that's crazy for even here. And I'm in Tucson, but yeah, you can imagine what our critters are going through out there, you know?
Yeah.
But anyway.
Yeah, I've been thinking about moving to Tucson for like a year or two just to do herping, so.
You'd love it. It's, I'm serious, you know, going out and driving at night after the monsoon rains, it's like Christmas.
That's the exact reason I want to go.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
And we do have a lot of. I want to get into those Sky Island mountains, so.
Get where?
I want to get into those Sky Island mountains.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they're easily accessible. They have light, nice, long roads, and some of them aren't well traveled on weekdays, or definitely not at night. And actually, again, what could people do? Bring your snake stick or tongs or whatever, because unfortunately, we still have a demographic of idiots here who think it's fun to run over rattlesnakes and tortoise. Yeah. So moving them out of the way, I don't want to say you should with threatened species, but, you know, I know it happens, and I tend to think it's probably better. Don't handle them with your hands. Like, good thing I just remembered. We transmit diseases easily to herps. So especially tortoise, just, you know, stand there and encourage the tortoise to leave the road if you can. That sort maybe of thing.
Maybe bring a box of sterile gloves.
Absolutely. Yeah, that sort of thing. So, but yeah, you'd love Tucson, even on the dirt roads. And, you know, one of Arizona's best kept secrets is the Chiricahua Sky Islands. Boy, still, it's a drive to get out there, about 3 hours from Tucson, but remote, very sparsely inhabited and rarely visited. And most of the time it's birders. But if you spend a couple of days out there in the monsoon season, driving the roads with spade foot toads and, you know, all kinds of snakes and lizards and amphibians, your brain will explode.
So you mentioned you did work with Gila monsters, and I've done a little bit of work in the captive setting with Gila monsters. Want to just talk about them a little bit, like their biology, like what threats they face?
Sure. My Gila monster work has been sort of inadvertent. You know, when I ran into them, I was a wildlife manager and always interested in conservation and collecting data. They're very uninterested in hurting anybody, as you, I'm sure, know. A lot of people think they're going to jump out and lunge for your throat, you know, that sort of thing. The general public.
That's like the monster I'd ever seen.
Yeah. So, you know, I've stood there and had them literally walk up and bump into my boot and just change direction. You know, just not interested at all. Very susceptible to roadkill, over collecting. But again, they seem to be doing all right. You know, they're mostly nocturnal, as you know, a lot of this, I'm sure. You don't see them out during the day very often, except this time of year, March, April, especially in the rains, warm days with high humidity, overcast, you're likely to run into one out there in the Bajadas or Creosote Flats. And a lot of times people have sent down the little, what do you call it, little scopes. It's not coming to mind. Same thing, they ram up your keister when they're looking for
Sort of camera. Colon. Yeah,
it's a camera. Go down there and, you know, you'll see a Gila monster in there with a rattlesnake, or, well, most of the time, not a rattlesnake, a tortoise, you know, just sharing the burrows. And that's a lot of fun just anyway. You know, what's down this burrow? You know, it could be mammals, but a lot of times it's just, that's where the herps are hanging out when it's cold or extremely hot. So we're still learning about Gila monster. And it's a really fascinating creature.
Yeah. There's one relatively new podcast I follow. It's called the Flipping 10 podcast. They were talking about those little things that you can get, like an attachment for your iPhone or something like that.
Oh, really? They
off,
have
off Amazon, and they're not too expensive.
No,
so.
go for it. I mean, it's fascinating.
Yeah. You
know? And again, it's low impact, and you're collecting data. You know, maybe you're in an area with a high Gila monster density, and believe me, there's very little known. We have range maps, but we don't know where the main concentrations are. When we were doing this power line work in Nevada, you know, watching for tortoise and endangered birds, whatever, one day we got 7 Gila monster just moving around, in about a 3-mile stretch of dirt road in a desert mountain range south of Vegas. I mean, you know, so if we're seeing 7 of them by accident, you know, just by, again, having a number of biologists out there, which doesn't happen all the time, Yeah, I think that's a good sign. I mean, what aren't we seeing? You know, so hopefully there's a nice healthy population still hanging on in most areas.
You did some, did you ever do any radio telemetry work with Gila monsters?
Not personally. A friend of mine did. She was working on the power line project as a contractor with many of us who were out there doing the same thing. And after that particular day, when we got seven, she stayed out and waited for Nevada Game and Fish, Fish and Game, I can't remember, to show up and attach the transmitters. And after that, they said, hey, do you mind coming out here once or twice a week and finding Mr. Gila Monster? And, you know, she had like five of them fitted with these radio transmitters. And a lot of data was collected just, again, by accident, being out there at the right time, you know, finding it, you know, even not looking for them, but because you were there. And this is what you were asking, what could people do? And calling your game and fish or fish and wildlife person. And the next thing you know, you're making a major contribution to reptile conservation.
Yeah. I just wanted to ask, is it true that Gila monsters will actually move quite a lot of long distances, a lot longer than people?
They have. They have. Yeah. And what really amazed me was the vertical movement was astounding. I mean, you know, you think bighorn sheep or something else. I mean, how these guys, I got to tell you, you know, 90 degree inclines, and, you know, you're like, wait a minute, that was 2 days ago. You know, how did this guy cross these creosote flats and low hills and climb that freaking cliff? You know, it's like, they're amazing. So I'm not sure I think the climbing is probably common, but I don't know how far they'll actually range. I'm not sure anyone can answer what is a normal distance.
What's a normal home range size?
Exactly.
Yeah.
But.
Yeah. So switching back to long-nosed leopard lizards, I also was lucky enough to find a few of those when I was out in Utah.
Beautiful little guys. Yeah.
Yeah, gorgeous little lizards.
Back in
summer 2020.
Were you near Kanab, or do you remember where you were at?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great area. You know, if you handle them, they're really tough little guys. They got attitude. they'll latch on. Yeah, well, herps will bite you. It's really, unless they're venomous, you might get a little prick or some abrasions, but you know, they're just doing what comes natural. But little leopard lizards, man, they're fast. They'll just take out, you know, their prey like that, you know, and lightning fast and take off with their meal. You know, it's amazing.
So speaking of their meal, what does their primary diet consist of? Imagine there's probably a lot of insects in it.
Insects and a lot of little lizards, you know, side blotched, zebra tailed, earless, you know. I couldn't tell you the makeup of their diet, you know, what percentage of herps, what percentage of insects is. It's probably opportunistic, you know, whatever they could get. But, you know, if they have access to a nice population of, you know, terrestrial lizards, I'm sure they'll take advantage of that.
Okay. And are they primarily, well, I guess like most lizards, they're a diurnal, but are they more crepuscular activity, or they're more of a midday activity?
No, more midday, like the desert iguana. That's another one I've worked with. We used to say when it's the hottest and nastiest and nothing else is out, that's when you'll find the desert iguanas. They like the heat. They like full sun. I mean, I don't know about this nonsense now with 45 days of 115 degrees plus, but yeah. And leopard lizards, they're not out quite in the middle of the day. They'll come out about 10 or as soon as it warms up, you know, they're out there unfortunately, in the middle of the road or on a rock, warming up. And, you know, they'll go hunting, and then I'm pretty sure they'll take cover, you know, at the worst, the hottest time of day. But the desert iguanas are out there. Just, I don't know what's up with them, but they like that heat.
Fermenting tough desert plants probably takes a lot of energy. So
yeah, that's true. Yeah. So
yeah, but when I was out in St. George, Utah, I was actually visiting. Me and a friend of mine were visiting a college friend who lived there at the time.
Fantastic. Yeah, great and spot.
Yeah, he's lived there for most of his life, and when we were out there, we found, like, you know, saw a leopard lizard several different times, and he was kind of mind blown because he lived out there this whole time and we easily doubled the amount of leopard lizards he's ever found in his life.
Because you're out there at a different time?
We just put it together. He was looking in the evenings and early mornings on the warmer parts of the day. So
yeah, fantastic. So yeah, I haven't really worked a lot in that area, but it's rich in, you know, herp fauna as far as I know. Was that your experience? Or?
I had a lot of lifers on that one half a week trip, so.
Were the snakes out at the same time?
We only found a couple of Great Basin rattlers.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, that's another one. We're still learning, as you know, about everything. But, you know, the snakes seem to be more crepuscular. You know, they move out, heat up, and then take cover or wait for prey. You know, they don't move around when it's blistering hot. You know, as you know, it'll be... when it's warm and hot, just not intolerable, you know, they'll move around. The same thing with the late in the day. Now, in the really hot spring and summer nights here in the Southwest, you know, they're out hours after sunset, as you probably know. And they're out hunting and moving around. And, you know, as the night tends to cool off, they become more inactive. But they seem to, like, take advantage of whatever the weather situation is, you know.
Yeah. Like, the biggest one we found was maybe like 1 or 2 a.m. in the morning, so.
Oh, really? Yeah. Were they just prairies mostly? I mean, Great Basins, or did you run into Diamondbacks or Blacktail, anything like that?
We tried so hard to find Mojaves, but we can only Great Basins.
Yeah.
That was only found 3 of them. One was like early in the, it's actually kind of funny story. It's early in the morning and we were leaving out to go herping for the day. Sure. And just before we hit a dead zone, you know, no signal zone, our friend's mom calls him and says, "Oh, hey, but there's actually a rattlesnake in the front yard." So
of course.
So we had to book it back.
Right. Or, you know, under the truck in camp, you know, it's another one is your getting in the car to leave and you hear a rattlesnake and they're underneath. Yeah. It's pretty cool. I mentioned the Chiricahua Mountains to you earlier. I mean, your head would explode there, Nate. I mean, twin spotted and, you know, Mojave, Diamondback. From Mojave Desert to, Alpine Zone, you know, the top of the Chiricahua's Rustler Park. You're in the spruce and, you know, pine, furs, and there's rattlesnakes at all life zones. It's awesome.
Yeah, is that where the ridge-nosed rattlers are found as well?
Yeah, well, Grand Canyon, you know, that's a good question. You got me there. I'd have to check on that about the ridge nose, but just about, you know, the Mississauga is also right there in the Chiricahuas. It's, you know, this one little pocket, you know, an isolated population in the Southwest, just south and east of the Chiricahua Mountain Range. It's kind of a desert, wetland, oasis situation there. But, you know, the biodiversity there in the Chiricahua Range and that part of southeast Arizona, southwest New Mexico, it's where the Sierra Madre kind of meets the Rocky Mountain, plus the Sonoran Mojave Desert, right? You know, it all mixes up. We have jaguar, coati, a lot of these subtropical birds and herps, and it's an amazing area.
Yeah,
Did you get ridge nose rattlesnake when you were in Utah, Arizona?
No, no, unfortunately. Like I said, the only ones we ever found were great basins.
Yeah.
I've never found all great basins. So
cool. I've never found ridge nose myself. But
we're kind of lucky on the second one, though, we had just like spread out on this one spot looking. My friend noticed a fresh shed. And so I just looked underneath a flat rock, and there it was sitting up in there. So
when was this now? A few months, weeks ago?
This was August of 2020.
Okay, so it was late summer. So yeah, it's still a great time, you know, to be out looking. What's your most memorable herp sighting out here in the Southwest, would you say?
It'd probably be that really large great basin we found at night. So
how big was it?
I could probably send you pictures later, but I'd say probably a solid 4 foot, maybe more than.
That's pretty damn good for a great basin rattlesnake. You know, they're not normally that big. They're usually about 2 to 3. Well, nowadays they're usually about 2 to 3 feet when you encounter. But
yeah.
Well, I hope you get to spend more time down here. If you need someone to come and carry your snake stick, you know, give me a call. Any excuse to get out. Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool.
What we say is the best time of year to go herping in the Southwest for the people who are listening?
Spring and late summer, I would say. You know, the best time to kind of best chance to see a good diversity of species, the weather, you know, the availability of water, you have the monsoon, and then you're just ending the winter rains. Vegetation's green. A lot of prey species are out in the spring. In the late summer and fall, you know, reproduction is winding down. Everybody's getting ready for the winter, you know, trying to fatten up on prey species. A lot of times, you know, we'll have, altitudinal migration, you know, especially here in Tucson, the tiger rattlesnakes will come down, and unfortunately the golf courses have trashed a lot of these areas, but they're still in the golf courses because the water attracts a lot of K-rats.
Yeah.
Other.
Yes.
But then, you know, they'll move up, you know, in the the summer months, you know, I guess it's a little cooler moving up in the summer. But, you know, a lot of times the population becomes isolated due to roads and all this habitat destruction. I really don't know the status. There's a couple of people down here who are, of course, herp experts. One of the tiger rattlesnakes rattlesnake guru down here is Matt Good. He's a professor at the University of Arizona here. But he'd be an interesting one to get hold
Matt
of.
Good.
Matt
Good.
Yeah,
I'm writing that one down. So.
G-O-D-E.
Okay, got it. Yeah, look that up right now. But tiger rattlers, that's another bucket list species for me there.
Yeah. Yeah, well, he's a guy I could literally, I mean, they used to let him just use a golf cart, drive around all night on the course. You know, I went out with him a few times and you got the whole place through, little bobcats with their kittens, and the tigers were still out there in the early spring, and he'll drive right up to it.
Yeah. I was about to say, a golf course with all that artificially concentrated water sounds like a herp magnet.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, actually reminds me of an experience. I was at a small Air Force Air Station near Gila Bend, population 3. You know, I'm not quite that low, but not a lot of people. And being with the DOD, I was screwing around with some night vision goggles one night. And of course,
the government job.
Oh yeah, one of the perks, and you know, being the military, all these little bases usually have a golf course, you know. So I went out to this little golf course, you know, and put on the night vision. And I was astounded, you know. It was like right where the desert meets the green grass on the golf course. I don't know the exact distance, but I swear it was almost like people placed them there. Every like 10 yards, there was a rattlesnake coiled facing the golf course, like waiting for the fast food to be delivered, you know. And I'm sure, you know, the herps, right? You'd go running in there too, nice green grass and water and whatever. And these rattlesnakes were just like they were placed out there. It was like every 10 yards. And I couldn't believe, you know, in the night vision, I could see them, but screwing around even with a flashlight, you know, they weren't so obvious. But that was kind of interesting.
Yeah. So have you done any herping outside the Southwest?
You know, I probably like you know, I'm a nature nerd, and my vacations are also out, you know, chasing critters and birding or herping or whatever. And so I've been lucky. I was in boy, I think it was yeah, it was Peru. And we had just walked around this dirt road one morning, and right across the dirt road was this 10-foot minimum 10-foot long red-tailed rock python, and it had just eaten. And you know, I mean, you just walk right up to it. It's like a little speed bump to step over. Just not concerned at all with us, and just
Python, you
wonder,
said?
yeah, python, a rock, yeah, rock python, rock boa, whatever you want to call it. And you looked that one up. I didn't realize it got so big, but it was a beautiful snake. And so I've been to Australia. You want to talk about a where herpers want to go and die? That's one of the places. Really amazing. And Papua New Guinea, I didn't, you know, boy, that place is just so thick, you know, vegetation wise and tropical. I saw a lot of birds of paradise and other wonderful things. But also, that's a one of the green tree boas is there, tree pythons, you know, it's beautiful.
Yeah, I have a green tree python right down there, so.
Oh, really? Okay, beautiful snake. And you know, in Australasia, right, you would probably know this better than me, but don't they have like a 140 species of snake or something like that, and like 100 are venomous,
Yeah.
you know?
Some
Wow.
ridiculously high proportion, yeah.
But that place, you'd be in heaven. You know, not just the snakes, but you know, the herps and amphibians. And well, of course, they're herps. And then, you know, I'm from Hawaii. I was fortunate enough to be born and raised there. But all the herps there, except the sea turtles, you know, the marine. And there's a sea snake that occasionally washes up on shore. You know, everything's introduced. So bring your field guide to the herps of Southeast Asia, you know, or Colombia or whatever. I mean, you know, Jackson's chameleons,
Day
Seychelles
gecko,
bay
yeah.
gecko, right? You know, the whole story. So that's interesting. But
Yeah.
yeah, I try. I've been lucky enough to visit some really nice places, and I'm always looking for herps and birds and mammals. So those were some of my more memorable experiences.
What would you say is your most memorable or herping find?
Yeah, that's a tough one. I did find a boy, I'd have to send you a photo. I found this really interesting turtle on Okinawa in a bamboo forest. It was an endemic, and it had jagged edges to the shell all the way around. And
Yeah.
the people I was with didn't even know what it was, but that was just really exciting, you know, for me. It wasn't an unknown species, but apparently rare enough that everybody, all the Japanese biologists got really excited. I'll have to look that one up. But one time a friend of mine was visiting from Hawaii, and we were out herping and birding out on the Goldwater Range in the middle of the Sonoran Desert, looking around all morning, you know, and didn't really have a lot of luck with herps. Got back into the pickup truck, and we're, you know, writing in our field notes, eating Twinkies, whatever, you know, and all of a sudden, this huge rattle goes off. I mean, it was the loudest rattlesnake I'd ever heard, and it was a huge, minimum of 5 feet, Mojave rattlesnake. And it was already under the truck, apparently, when we came back and got in. But sitting in the truck and bouncing around, he wasn't happy about that, and he let us know it. But we took some pictures, that sort of thing. So that was – and the Gila monsters. I get Gila monsters. I love Gila monsters. They're just cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Is there any piece of kit or gear that you would recommend all people should carry with them when they go herping?
Definitely your phone or a camera. You know, and again, a location is really important. Even if you don't have a GPS, you could say east of St. George, you know, something like that, because data is very important. And all you got to do is see it, record it, and report it, and it goes a long way towards conservation. So maybe some, you know, latex, not latex, what do they call it? The gloves.
Like silicone, you know, is that what it?
I can't remember. Just latex gloves are fine. Just that, maybe a herp stick, you know, snake stick, or tongs. Yeah. Binoculars are good too, because, you know, some species you don't want to disturb them or get in the face of a big Mojave rattlesnake or something, but you can really pick up detail even 5 feet away with a good pair of binoculars.
Something
to record your field notes, either a little, you know, record it on your phone or a notebook. And in terms of kit, those are the basics.
Okay. I remember you mentioned you did some work with sea turtles over in the Pacific. You want to talk about that?
Sure. Wonderful animals. When I was growing up in Hawaii, I did a lot of, you know, skin diving, you know, without a tank, snorkeling, spearfishing, all that. And you rarely saw a sea turtle. You know, they had just been pretty much wiped out around the main islands, and or just learn to stay away, you know, to survive. And since the hunting ban went into effect and people got educated, they are now hauling out on several main islands, laying eggs. You got hawksbill, green sea turtles. I believe Olive Ridley, I could be wrong. I never encountered those personally. But, you know, they'll haul out now. You could be on your towel 10 feet away, you know, with a basking sea turtle right next to you. And you'll see them a lot of times at different tides eating the seaweed, you know, we call limu, and swimming. Now you can see them regularly, even snorkeling. But we would tag them. You know, since then, I'm sure they did a lot of satellite telemetry. The movement of sea turtles, as you know, is astounding. You know, they cross the oceans and really circumnavigate the globe. A lot of them, like the leatherback. But it's a beautiful, beautiful animal. One animal that really fascinates me are sea snakes. You know, especially the pelagic open ocean, oceanic ones that just drift with the currents. And, you know, we don't know a lot about them.
Yeah. Well, I do live in Earth's most remote habitat.
I'm sorry?
Well, they do live in Earth's most remote habitat, so probably pretty hard to find them.
Yeah, it is. I mean, in Hawaii, I've never known anybody to find one alive swimming around. I found them. It's the yellow-bellied sea snake, beautiful blue and yellow and black. They'll wash up after storms on the beach. In the Southwest Pacific, you know, like the Solomon Islands and getting out that way, Palau, Micronesia, you know, you've got them. They'll come ashore, you know, you run into them in the mangroves or rocks on the beaches and whatever, and then they'll, you know, return to the ocean and hunt and breed and whatever. But I mean, the deep sea snakes like the yellow belly, they're just out there, you know, floating around and, you know, 10,000 feet of water, you know, I'd be worried, you know, with all the tiger sharks and everything out, but they seem to be doing very well.
Yeah. Well, I can't think of any questions off the top of my head. Is there anything else you want to talk about?
Well, I've been doing most of the talking, but I appreciate your giving me the forum to talk about conservation and some of the concerns. And also, it's fun to just talk herps with someone, you know, a colleague. So I really appreciate the opportunity, Nate.
Yeah, thank you.
So do you post weekly or every daily or what on your blog?
I pretty much upload as soon as I can get done with all the editing and stuff like that. But it's not, I don't do it as regularly as I want to, but
I basically do it as soon as
I can get guests on. But
cool. Well, you know, it goes a long way. You know, I think one of the best things anyone can do nowadays is spread the word, environmental education, conservation, you know, getting the kids interested, you know, what's out there, everything, you know, they're playing with phones and computers now, but getting one of them out to handle a little snake or turtle, you know, goes a long way. And your blog reaches lots of people, I'm sure. So I just want to express appreciation for what you're doing.
No, thank you. So if people want to get in contact with you, what would be a preferred way to do that?
Email. I'm on Facebook, but if you want to just contact me directly, I'm open to that. I'm always up for anything to do with wildlife and people's interests, helping them learn or even, you know, see things, you know, find them. But my email is Bruce, Bruce.Eilerts, my last name, Eilerts, @gmail.com.
All right. Thanks for coming on the show.
Well, thank you. Looking forward to seeing your future features as well. And thank you again.
That's been my pleasure.
Take care.